Well, good morning and thank you very much. Thank you all. It's a privilege to be here with all of you today. You know, I'm a researcher and a lot of people ask me, well, why do you do research? And the reason is because things are constantly changing. I mean, you think about how quickly things change in our nation, how quickly they change in your business. You think about it, you know, I mean, less than 10 years ago, we had Johnny Cash, Steve Jobs, and Bob Hope. Today we have no cash, no jobs, and no hope. So it's, things change quickly. It's not actually true. Whenever you have Christ at the center of your life, you always have hope. So I don't want to mislead you on that. But you do need to understand that every one of us in here, every person on earth has a God-given purpose. And you may seek to fulfill it through the church, through a nonprofit organization, through your business, through your family, as an individual, a combination of these. But the important thing to understand is that as you seek to fulfill that purpose, it's going to be done in the context of battle, the spiritual battle that rages around us at all times. You're going to meet resistance. And in order to overcome the challenges that you'll face in pursuing that purpose, you have to, as the Bible tells us, understand the times and know what to do. My argument here today is that, yes, things are changing rapidly in America. We need to understand those changes. But you and your business play an important and significant role in the healing and the future of America. We're going to talk about that. I have a book that came out just a couple of days ago called America at the Crossroads. And that title is very important because I do full-heartedly believe that America is at a crossroads. It's a time where we need to make a decision about our future. People are seeking leadership to define who we as a nation, who we as individuals will be, to help us understand where we are and where we're going. I would suggest to you that as we start to look at some of the slides, and I'll be showing slides all throughout the presentation to help you understand what in the world it is I'm saying. What we've got is a situation which is very unusual, convergence of many different influence entities in our culture all at the same time trying to figure out answers to those questions. Who are we going to be and where do we want to go? This really is a key hinge point in American history. That's why it's called a crossroads. And that, by the way, is why this election matters so much. So much of the direction that these entities may choose to follow will be determined by this coming election. We'll get back to that in a little bit. But understand that there are huge opportunities right now for business to lead in the midst of this important historical moment. Think about your business. I would suggest that there are probably seven primary segments of people that you get to influence. We could talk about your customers, the people that you hire, your employees, your vendors, regulators, whether that's government agencies or industry entities. We could talk about your competitors, your potential customers, other people in your industry, your professional peers or industry peers. But to influence any and hopefully all of those, you have to understand the time. So I want to spend our time here together talking about some of the information that's in that book, America at the Crossroads. I want to talk about what are some patterns that you need to understand to operate your business better and to have the kind of influence that you want to have and to be able to fulfill the purpose that God has given to you. One of those patterns that I think is important for you to understand is the fact that people in America are seeking happiness. As we've been studying what it is that drives Americans, what is it that they want perhaps more than anything else, happiness is one of the key things, if not the most important thing that they're seeking. Oddly enough, we discovered that most Americans believe the Constitution guarantees them life, liberty, and happiness, which simply shows you that very few people have ever read the Constitution or have a clue what's in it because it does nothing of the kind. But when we look at people's opinions, what we find is that most people would say that success means being happy. And so to them, those words are almost interchangeable. And then when we talk with them about, well, what is it that will deliver that kind of success that brings us happiness in life, we find that they talk about doing things like achieving personal goals, or having strong relationships, ongoing relationships with family and friends, or loving what you do for a living. All of these things are critically important to Americans, but what's critical to understand about this is that we undermine ourselves, we prevent ourselves from actually achieving some of these things. For instance, when people say, well, you know, if you achieve personal goals, that will bring you happiness and success. What we know is in America today, fewer than one out of every four people actually has any specific goals for their life. We look at the fact that they say, well, having good relationships with family and friends will deliver that kind of success and happiness. But what we find is that Americans have a revolving door of relationships. It used to be that we were loyal to a handful of people. We stuck with them the duration of our lives. We no longer do that. Now, every year or two, we drop one or two of the people in our circle of five or six closest friends, replace them with somebody else who makes us feel better, more comfortable, etc. We look at the whole aspect of getting satisfaction and success and happiness from our work. But we know recently, research has shown us that fewer than one out of three Americans is actually feeling engaged in the work that they do from day to day. And so all of this helps to explain why so few Americans are feeling very happy with their lives, feeling very successful about what's going on. We're divided roughly into thirds, about a third who would say they're very happy, a third are somewhat happy, and one third would say they're really not happy. See, and partly this is because in an ADD society like ours, we try to avoid paying the dues. We want instant gratification. We want immediate happiness without having to go through all the hard work to get there. And when we do have happiness, it's fleeting because we're trying to get it from experiences rather than from who we are and what that provides within our lives. We could look at some other major sources of happiness that people have talked about, watching children or grandchildren succeed, kissing or hugging somebody that you love, having that emotional connection, being told you can be trusted or rely upon, spending time with family and friends, experiencing a special moment with a child. And again, when we look at these sources of happiness, we find, yes, we continue to undermine our own ability to achieve happiness. Why? Because you think about children, you know, whether you want to watch children or grandchildren succeed or have special moments with them. At the same time that that's true, we know that people are having fewer children than they've had at any time in the last century. And we also know that fewer people are having any children. In fact, when we look at the millennials, what we find is that a majority of them say they don't want children for a variety of reasons. But essentially what they've done is they've removed one of the building blocks of what seems to be a means to happiness. We can look at the fact that when people say, yeah, relationships are critical, spending time with family and friends and whatnot, again, we have fewer of those close and lasting relationships. Even marriage, what we know is that in America today, a majority of young people will probably never get married unless something significant changes in terms of America's primary attitudes. Cohabitation, they're completely satisfied with. Every 4, 5, 6 years, they'll change partners, and they'll try it again. And they believe that that's a viable replacement for marriage. Trust, being a trusted person, someone who can be relied upon, increasingly Americans are skeptical and cynical. We believe that everybody is out for themselves. And Americans tend to believe that because they're out for themselves. And so they assume everybody else has the same perspective. And so all of this prevents us from achieving what we're looking for. You see, the cultural application of the idea of happiness for so many years was this thing that we called the American Dream. And if you look at the American Dream, it had a number of different elements to it. But it had to do with believing that if you work hard, you could get ahead. Believing that if you work hard and get ahead, you could buy a house, you could own your own home, and therefore have an environment that allowed you to live comfortably within it. You could have a fulfilling marriage and family life with children, you know, and growing up and raising them and having those kinds of joys. You could take advantage of the numerous opportunities that America, the greatest country on earth, offered to people. You could practice any faith, the faith of your choice. However you chose to practice it with whatever group of people worked for you. And ultimately, yes, you had an incredible degree of freedom. You could balance that with the responsibilities that freedom brings with it. That reflected our desires for decades and decades. But over the last two decades in particular, there have been a lot of questions raised about the American dream. What we're finding now is that more and more people, particularly those under the age of 40, no longer believe the American dream is relevant to the American experience. We find that 7 out of 10 people say that the obstacles to experiencing and enjoying the American dream are more extreme than they've ever been. We know that 6 out of 10 Americans say that this American dream that I just described is impossible for most people to achieve. Most individuals in our country say it's no longer a country where everyone has the opportunity to get ahead and move up to a better standard of living. And almost 2/3 of all adults now believe that today's children will grow up having a worse life than their parents had. This is the first decade in America's history, at least since we've had this kind of research available, that parents believe they will have had a better life than their children will have. So what's happening? What's filling the void? There's a new kind of dream, and I would call it the new millennium dream. This is important for you to understand because many of the people that you may employ embrace this kind of thinking, and it affects what they do on the job, how they relate to you in that workplace. You know, the new millennium dream basically says, yeah, I'm going to work, but I'm only going to work as much as I have to get by. I just want to have enough money so that I can enjoy myself. They're going to want a customized family experience. The traditional family system for most Americans now is not a driving force. It's not something that they embrace. Most Americans, and I'll show you data on this in a few minutes, would now describe themselves as spiritual but not religious, meaning that they have some spiritual stuff inside themselves, but they're not really connected with any group or any theology or any doctrine. Most of the people who buy into the new millennium dream would say, you know, we're entitled to freedom and rights. Big change. The key word there is entitled. It used to be that you would have to earn those things. You had a responsibility to maintain them. Most people pursuing this particular dream say that morality is important, but nobody can tell me what's moral or ethical or right. I'm the only person who can know that for my own life. Anybody who tries to impose their values, their morals, their ways upon me is behaving inappropriately. And of course, the whole idea now of happiness is shifting to things such as comfort and convenience, having multiple choices at all times, being deeply connected, and having what they would consider to be momentarily fulfilling experiences. See, all of that kind of dream, it probably feels good to some, but it works to our detriment because the fundamental principles that underlie it are at odds not only with the scriptures, but with the very foundations of what has made this country great. And so as we look at that as an employer, you're going to have to battle with some of these choices, these desires, these expectations that come with this kind of a dream. And you might say, well, how did we get there? And part of it has to do with the fact that another pattern we've been tracking now for over 30 years is the shift in America's worldview. It may sound like a fancy word. A worldview is simply the emotional and spiritual and intellectual perspectives that you have that enable you to interpret and understand and respond to the world around you. Everybody has a worldview. You have to have one to get by. But what we know is that when we look at America's worldview, currently only 4% of Americans possess a biblical worldview. Now, biblical worldview used to be the dominant worldview in American society. But at least for the last 30 to 40 years, that's been dramatically shifting. And you would say, well, yeah, but that's the country as a whole. What about born-again Christians? You're right. It's twice as much for born-again Christians. Among born-again Christians, it's only 9% who have a biblical worldview. Only 51% of the pastors of Protestant churches have a biblical worldview. That's how rapidly we're shifting away from this. Why does that matter? Because we do what we believe. We do what we believe, and our worldview reflects the things that we believe.
You see, the problem, therefore, is if we do what we believe, you cannot live like Jesus unless you can think like Jesus. And our worldview indicates that we don't think like Jesus, and therefore we don't have much chance of living like him until that changes. As we look at, you know, many of the shifts taking place, one of the key things that's driven this shift in worldview is the fact that most Americans now believe there is not and cannot be any such thing as absolute moral truth. A different way of stating that, 2 out of 3 Americans believe that all truth is relative to the individual and to his or her circumstances in the moment. And so they will determine on the fly what is right or wrong based on their feelings. What we know is that only 1 out of every 10 Americans believe that there is such a thing as absolute moral truth and that it can be found in the Bible. So, you know, the dominant worldview in place, what is it? You've heard of it. I'm not going to spend much time on this, but it's this thing called postmodernism. This is important for you to understand because most of the people working for you, most of these suppliers you work with, the regulators that you're dealing with, everybody that you come in contact with, a majority of them have this worldview. Now, nobody has a pure worldview. It's always a synthesis of ideas from various worldviews. But I would suggest that somewhere on the order of about 7 out of 10 Americans are driven by a postmodern worldview. And so, you know, it's made up of the things that you see on the screen there. A postmodern person believes that their life really flows along through the course of the day with a series of random experiences that gives their life meaning and expression. They would believe that feelings and relationships really provide the context and the purpose for their life. They would say that truth is always relative and nobody can impose anything upon them. That's inappropriate because everybody's on a unique and independent journey, and they're determining what's right or wrong for them. Nobody else can do that for them. There's no grand narrative for life, if you will. The Bible gives us a grand narrative, but most Americans would say there is no such thing as a grand narrative that puts all of life in context, gives us direction, purpose, understanding, meaning, identity, and so forth. They would say, I'm the only one that can figure that out for me. And that's why in a moment I'm going to show you being independent is so critical in American society. We look at, you know, how a lot of this comes about, and I would suggest that everybody's worldview is significantly influenced by their values. Last year, David Barton and I wrote a book together trying to trace America's history, trying to understand what made America great and what happened. And a major part of what we saw happening had to do with the shift in values that's taken place. If you look historically at our values, if you look at that slide up on the screen, on the left-hand side, it shows what we believe were the dominant values of colonial America. And they remained the dominant values of the nation up through the middle of the 19th century, maybe a little bit beyond that. After that point, things started to change very, very, very slowly. Not the kind of change that we see happening today. But when you look at those, I mean, look at those values: hard work, civic duty, humility, moderation, family, faith, rule of law, frugality, simplicity. That's what made America great. People bought into those values. They said, this is what matters. This is the reflection of a person with the right heart and the right mind, and it will come out in the way that we live. And it did. But then you look at the current American values in that right-hand column: comfort, experiences, expression, happiness, independence, entertainment, control, acceptance, freedom, on and on. Those are the dominant values of our day. And when you think about, well, what would that look like if it gets played out, if people begin to practice those values, that's how you get to a postmodern society. Because that's what postmodernism looks like when you follow it through. What could shift us back closer to something like we used to have in colonial days? Now, I'm not saying, you know, everything should go back to what it was, but I am saying we want values that honor God, values that reflect his principles as given to us in his word. The values of today generally do not do that. So how do we move us back to something that might? Well, typically you would say it's the institutions in a society that have the influence and the authority, the power, the will to move people toward that. But the problem is, when you look at the institutions in our society, you can see the pattern of how quickly we're losing confidence and trust in our core institutions. In fact, if you look at this particular chart, and I know it's a lot of numbers and I'm moving quickly, it's all in the book if you want to get it, but if you look at that third item down, the third row down where it talks about churches, one of the primary jobs of churches is to help us determine what are appropriate values so that we can live in an appropriate way. But what you see is that the church, or organized religion, whatever you want to call it, is dropping in public confidence fastest of all the major institutions in our culture. So the influence clearly is not going to come from there. You may say, well, what difference does this make? Let's take an example. Let's take government, because you got several different entities there that represent government. If we were to look at the loss of faith in government, I mean, people look at our culture and they say, well, it's not really uniting us. The government is actually dividing us. 3 out of 4 Americans believe that. 3 out of 4 Americans are dissatisfied with the way that we're being governed. Most of our government officials get very low evaluations from the public in terms of the job that they're doing. Almost 9 out of 10 Americans believe that Congress is more interested in serving special interest groups than in serving the people that put them into office in the first place. You look at the fact that 2 out of 3 people say they're usually disappointed by the folks they vote for. Only about 1 out of every 16 Americans say that they feel very certain that the government has their best interest as the public at heart. And you find that 6 out of 10 Americans say that the government has too much power. You look at all of those things and you start to begin to understand why people would lose confidence in the government. They don't see it doing what they expect it to do. So when your dream is shattered and your worldview has shifted and your values have changed, your core institutions are faltering, what does it look like? Well, here is one way it looks like. Think about the moral behaviors of Americans today. This is one of the areas that we focus on a lot. I could give you a lot of slides. I'd love to show you a lot more on this. But here's just a very simple snapshot of what Americans now believe moral behavior looks like. What does moral mean? The right thing to do. So they would believe that the right thing to do is to get a divorce. It's okay with 2/3 of Americans to have a sexual relationship between an unmarried man and an unmarried woman. 2/3 believe gambling is morally acceptable. 2 out of 3 say enjoying sexual thoughts or fantasies about someone you're not married to is morally acceptable. 2 out of 3 say gay or lesbian relationships, morally acceptable. 2 out of 3, cohabiting with someone of the opposite sex, morally acceptable. 6 out of 10 saying having a child without being married, the two people who created the child being married, 6 out of 10, morally acceptable. You'll see some other things there that are below the 50% threshold. I will tell you that everything that you see there was down in the 20 or 30% range less than 10 years ago. And so all of those are rapidly moving into widespread public acceptance. I would shortcut it and say we are essentially moving toward a period in American history where we are accepting moral anarchy as an appropriate way to live. Now, what could prevent that slide? I would say certainly one of the things that should would be people's faith. Believing that what God told us is true, believing that he cares about the choices that we make, believing that he will guide us in those kinds of choices. But in order to embrace that kind of thinking, you would have to make faith something critical in your life. And what we know in America today is only about 1 out of every 4 people considers their faith to be the highest priority in their life. Most people do not really embrace churches as a place where they're going to get truth or guidance or help or assistance or knowledge or wisdom. They accept it as a place where they may find friends, where they may be able to develop community, but they're not necessarily looking to it for much else. Faith in American society is becoming increasingly peripheral. I mean, remember, you know, we do what we believe. The problem is we no longer believe that Christianity is central to who we are as individuals. And so that's why, for instance, fewer and fewer people consider themselves to be deeply spiritual individuals. That's why the percentage of people is dropping very rapidly, of those people who say that their faith is very important to themselves. We look at the fact that only one out of every four Americans currently say that they have any kind of responsibility to talk about and share their religious beliefs with other people who believe differently. We look at the fact that those who believe in the God described in the Scripture, the God of Israel, actually exists, that he's real. Only about 6 out of 10 Americans buy that now. That also continues to drop. The Bible, most people do not believe that it's totally accurate in all of the principles that it teaches. We look at the fact that only about 3 out of 10 say that, or excuse me, as many now as 3 out of 10 say that the Bible is neither the actual or the inspired word of God, but that it was just a good book that was written by men. And this idea of having a personal commitment to Christ, the idea has, again, been declining very rapidly in recent years. More and more people are actually questioning the value of the church. Some of our recent research found that when we talked with people about the value of the church, we found that they're now doubting whether or not churches have their best interests in mind. They're not sensing the presence of God at church. In fact, when we did a study, wrote a book a couple years ago with David Kinneman, who I sold the Barna Group to a few years back. And one of the things that we discovered in that research is that among unchurched people, when we asked them, why don't you go to church, the number one answer we got from them is because when I go there, I don't sense that God is there. And so they have no interest in being just in another social meeting place. If they're simply looking for a social gathering place, they're capable of coming up with their own, and it would look radically different. The busyness of our lives is one of the things that keeps people from feeling that the church is worth the effort. The fact that fewer and fewer people are having children is one of the things that bring people to church. But if you're not having children, that takes away one of the arguments for going to church. Not believing in the Bible, not feeling that church teaching or theology or doctrine is useful, all of these things have contributed to the fact that particularly in the last 5, 6, 7 years, we've had a massive outflow of people from the organized church. If you look at that chart, I mean, that's one of the more startling charts I could show you. Because as a social scientist, I don't see rapid change like that very often. But when you look at the fact that we've gone from about 28% of the adult population being unchurched just 6 years ago to 45% today, a 60% growth in 5 years, really? That's huge. And that speaks volumes about what's going on in our culture. So we look at, you know, all of this, but I know this is hard. You know, I work at United in Purpose. We have a division that I run, a research division called the American Culture and Faith Institute. And my boss there, Bill Dallas, says, you know, one of the things you can always count on when George speaks is that at the end you'll want a razor blade, you know. Thanks, boss. You know, but, you know, I do want to suggest to you that things are not hopeless. And that is because of a very simple reason. God exists, we have his story, we know how he operates, and one of the truths about what God does is he always does incredible things, but he only uses a remnant of people. There's no time in human history that we can document where God waited until he had a majority to get something significant done. In fact, there are many times in Scripture where what you see is that God has a certain body of people, and he says, nah, that's too many. You guys stay away. I'm just going to use this little part of you over here to get the job done. So it's not about numbers of people in order to do it. What he wants is people whose hearts are completely wedded to and sold out to him in order to get the work done. And so if we've got those kind of people in here, you know what? It can happen. But we've also got to understand that the church, the organized church, the body of believers that comes together to encourage and teach and instruct and support each other, has a role in all of this. And what we know is that right now, the remnant, in America at least, is asking to be equipped. I mentioned that, you know, the election is a good example of some things. I'd suggest that the election is a great example of this too, where what we have right now is the remnant of God in America saying, please, church, equip me to go out and do battle in the culture wars. And so we look at the fact that, you know, 10% of conservative Christians in our country say that their church was very involved in the last election cycle. Only 10%. And in fact, only 8% of the senior pastors of conservative churches across the country said their church had a lot of influence. So in essence, they agree. We found that 6 out of 10 conservative Christians in America said that they want their church more involved in the election. 3 out of 4 conservative pastors agreed, yes, that should happen. Only 1 out of every 4 conservative churches said that their church has been providing a lot of teaching related to the issues. What's interesting about that is that 92% of theologically conservative pastors in America say the Bible speaks to every issue that's being raised in this current election. And 2 out of 3 of the people in their congregations are saying, well, please tell me what the Bible says about the issues. The saddest part of all is that pastors are saying, the Bible speaks to those issues, but I'm not going to. And so what we've got is a group of individuals who we've placed in positions of leadership who are not doing what the people they've been called to lead need. Why not? Because we discovered that most pastors base their behavior on what they think success in ministry is. And as we studied it, we found that most of them measure 5 things to determine whether or not their church is successful. Attendance, giving, number of programs, number of staff to run those programs, and the square footage that's been built out on the campus. Now look, I'm a measurement guy, so I'm just thrilled that churches are actually measuring something. Okay? But as a measurement guy, one of the things that I've learned over the last 30-some years is you get what you measure. And so if you don't measure the right things, you'll get the wrong outcomes. What do we measure? We're measuring stuff that Jesus never died for. He didn't die to fill auditoriums. He didn't die so that we'd have more programs than the church down the street. He didn't die so that we'd have the biggest building program, more square footage built out than our neighboring churches. He died so that our lives would be completely transformed and focused on his purposes, committing our lives to doing what matters to him, not what matters to us, not what makes us feel good. And so we have these kinds of issues where our pastors are refusing to teach God's people what God's word says about the issues. They're not saying, tell me who to vote for. They're saying, teach me how to think biblically. This is why we've got 9% of born-again Christians in America with a biblical worldview. Because we don't help people tie the knot. We don't put it all together for them. It goes even a little bit further in this particular election, where there are a number of things that our churches could be doing to help Christians carry out their biblical responsibility to be involved in the culture and to do simple things like voting. But our churches won't even get involved to that degree. I mean, when you have churches where only 5% of theologically conservative churches across the country are even willing to put the date of the election on their church website, we've got an issue. When you've got churches where, only 1 out of 4 will encourage their people to participate in the process, you've got an issue, and it goes on and on and on. So yeah, we have these kinds of things. But what I want to suggest to you, bottom line, is that yes, America's at a cultural crossroads, and we have to determine who we're going to be and which way we're going to go. Now, I know many of you, there are a lot of other trends we could talk about. I don't have time for it. So I want to suggest to you that many, if not most of you, or maybe all of you, know this concept of the 7 mountains of culture. These are essentially the 7 different dimensions of our culture that have influence on who the nation will become. I typically speak about five of these, you know, because as we've done our research trying to figure out what really does have influence in our culture, don't get upset, but typically I find that business and religion have very little influence on the direction of the culture. That's why I was excited when Terrence asked me if I would come and share some things with you people, because you can change that. You may be the only people that can change that, but God uses a remnant to alter the world. Business and religion don't have the influence they ought to have, and not religion, but the Christian faith really is the key here. At a hinge point of history, any of these different sectors of influence could literally change the future of this nation for decades and decades to come. And I'd like to challenge you in here to step up and make the business sector perhaps the one that will dictate which way this culture goes. You can do that. But how does that work? First thing I'd suggest to you is that you've got to provide leadership that gives people a common or shared vision of what the future is going to look like. A vision basically is simply a compelling mental portrait of a preferable future, a future that's communicated by God to his chosen leaders or servants based upon an accurate understanding of God, self, and circumstances. And the purpose of that vision that he gives us as leaders is not to grow our business, it's not to enhance the culture, it's to advance his kingdom. And one of the key things that I want to point out here is that this is not a vision that you come up with at a retreat with your executives. This is a vision from God given to you. This may be the greatest treasure that he ever gives to you as a leader. Because I'd suggest, as many of you know, most of you may know this, you can't lead without vision. And the only way you lead effectively is if it's God's vision and not yours. So can you identify what that vision is? Can you actually communicate that to the people who you influence? We looked before at the seven different segments that you get to influence. You know, and God talks about how critical that vision is. You know, the essence of it is that where you don't have God's revelation, God's vision, people cast off restraint. They run wild. They do whatever is right in their own eyes. And that's what we have going on in America, because we do not have godly leadership pointing us in the direction that God would have us go. I'd suggest to you that, you know, America is dying without God's vision. And we can see it in the fact that 3 out of 4 Americans right now are concerned about the future of the country. When you have strong, godly, visionary leadership, people aren't worried about the future. They're excited about the future because they know where they're going. They know how they're going to get there. They have confidence in the leaders because that vision has been made clear. We don't have vision. Most of our companies haven't given that kind of vision. Certainly our political leaders haven't given that vision. Because I study them, I can tell you that the vast majority, more than 90% of Christian churches in this country, haven't provided that kind of vision. And that's why America is at a crossroads today. We don't have that kind of visionary leadership that's beholden to God's idea of what our future should be. Most people believe the country is headed in the wrong direction. They're dissatisfied with how things are going. And check out that last thing up there. 3 out of 4 Americans today are trying to figure out how they can add greater meaning and direction to their life. They don't even know where they're going. It's a total chaotic mess. And so how do we help them with that? Well, I'd suggest that one of the things that you can do is help them pursue God's transformation in their life. I'd love to come back sometime and spend a whole session on this. I spent 6 years studying how God transforms people's lives. Interviewed 19,000 people across the country, tracked their journeys, tried to figure out what are the patterns, and some things came out. But what you have to understand is that if I just bottom line all of it, because I've got about 4 minutes left, what I know is that essentially we are not pursuing God's transformation because we refuse to allow him to break us of sin, self, and society. The churches don't preach about this. Our institutions don't support broken people. In fact, our society says if you're a broken individual, you're a loser. You don't want to be broken. You want to be strong. You want to be an overcomer. Absolutely not. The only time you're strong is when you're weak, because your strength comes from Christ and Christ alone. But in order to get there, you have to allow him to break you. He uses crises to do this. But you see, in our churches, and I know this from the research, when somebody goes through a crisis, what we try to do is embrace them and tell them, don't worry about it, it's all going to get better. We're going to make it better. No, we're not. We're going to make it worse by trying to make it better. The only one who can make it better is Christ when we admit that we've got nothing to bring to the table, that he's all we've got. And that changes our entire perspective about how we move forward. And the last thing I'll say about this transformation piece, I'd love to talk more about it. But the last thing that you have to understand is the way that people grow, the way that people get transformed, they have that crisis, and then they're coached through the journey through somebody who's one or two stops further ahead on the journey. Coaching is absolutely critical in this. And so think about the relational networks that you develop in your companies and how that works. I'd suggest that even this kind of transformation doesn't work unless at the same time we're trying to help people develop a biblical worldview. Remembering that everybody has a worldview, most people's worldview develops by default. Most people right now that you have working in your company in all likelihood have a postmodern worldview and didn't even know it. They wouldn't recognize it. But the issue here is that by interacting with people, we can start to challenge what it is that they've embraced without even realizing it. Again, studying how worldviews develop, what we learned is that it's mostly by asking questions of people. It's not by telling them doctrinal point after point. They resist that. Why? Because you're imposing something upon their thinking. They don't want that. We're in a culture now that doesn't buy that. But if you engage them in conversation and you're simply asking question after question after question about what they say they believe, so that once they hear themselves explain what they say they believe, even they're thinking to themselves, although they may not say it out loud, wow, that's really stupid. And so having that kind of relationship where you can have those conversations, you can ask those key questions about the things they believe, the values they've embraced, the principles that they live by, the outcomes that they're pursuing, that really is critical toward helping to develop a biblical worldview. Final thing I'll suggest that's important to you, as we're trying to get this culture back on track, is to engage in measurement. Measurement is critical. I can't tell you how many churches I go to and I say, how are you doing? Oh, we're doing great. Lives are changing. How do you know? Oh, they tell me. Really? Is that all you got? I mean, we've got to have objective measures. When you look at your company, you don't go to your CFO and say, how are we doing? And the CFO says, oh, great. How do you know? I just feel it in my bones. You want the numbers. Well, it's the same way with cultural development, with cultural resurrection, which is really what we're talking about here. And so it's critical that we measure the right things. I mean, Jesus never said, you are my disciples if you feel like you're a disciple. I mean, what he literally said to them is, you are my disciples if you bear fruit. And so what does fruit look like in your environment? It's got to be more than just making money. Making money's not bad. I'm not against it. I believe in it. But I don't believe in it as much as I do believe in God's principles. And so what do those principles look like when they're translated into what your business can do to help bring America back from the brink? You know, in the end, I'd ask you to take a look at some questions. Are you casting God's vision for your business and for people's lives, all the people who you affect through your business, those seven niches that we talked about earlier? Are you recognizing and celebrating brokenness in people's lives? You may even have the privilege of helping bring that about for some people. And you may say, oh my gosh, who would want to bring about brokenness? It's going to be the highlight of a person's life. They may not understand it as such, but you can help them to experience it that way. Are you helping people develop a worldview that honors God and advances his purposes? And are you measuring what matters objectively and then changing accordingly? I'd suggest to you that this is very much the biblical model, where when we look at the men of Issachar, as talked about in 1 Chronicles 12, It was said that these were men, just 200 and their relatives, who understood the signs of the times and knew the best course to take. That's what we as leaders are being called to do, is to understand the times and identify the best course to take given God's objectives for our life. And Jesus himself criticized many of the people around him because they were talking about all kinds of things that were going on. Basically, he said, how is it that you know how to forecast the weather, but you have no idea how to forecast what's going on in the world around you? Because if you want to make a difference for God, you've got to be able to do that. I'm hoping that, you know, through the book, and we've got a weekly newsletter, SageCon Weekly. You can sign up for that for free at our culturefaith.com website. But I'm hoping that these things will help you, and that with so many of the other resources that you have available to yourselves through FCCI, that you can begin to advance a different kind of culture. America is at the crossroads, and it's going to be God's leaders who can dictate where this country goes. But that means that you've got to stand up and take advantage of that opportunity. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity.